Hello, this is your host Narina, and welcome to The Startup Way, a podcast where we unveil stories behind the scenes of startups' glorious success and drastic failure, spark thought-provoking conversations with investors, and engage leading experts to reveal what the future of technology beholds. The podcast series are powered by SSS Venture Capital Firm, here to help you start, scale, and succeed in the startup world.
Hi, today I have the pleasure of hosting Haik Mamajanyan, who's a corporate and venture capital attorney. Haik is a partner at Dreamen Law Firm. He's also a startup advisor and investor. Haik, thank you for joining our podcast.
Hi, Narina. Thank you for having me.
Law for early stage startups can be very confusing. Navigating the legal requirements and formalities involved in fundraising, forming, or running a startup can be challenging. And I hope that our conversation will provide entrepreneurs with some clarity and guidance for their legal questions. My first question is related to entity formation. Choosing the right legal structure for your startup, such as a corporation or a limited liability company, is crucial. This decision affects issues like personal liability, taxation, government, and fundraising options. What legal considerations should a startup keep in mind when selecting a business structure?
Yeah, thank you, Narina. This is a great question. And first off, just very quickly, I want to make sure that people understand that this is for informational purposes only, and this shouldn't be considered as legal advice, and they should consult with a professional about their own individual needs. And pretty much everything we say is probably going to apply to Delaware C corporations only. It will apply to other types of entities and other corporations in other states as well, but I'm going to be focusing on Delaware C Corps as the main form of startup legal entities. And just to address your questions, so when you start a new business, a startup, as an attorney, I like to focus on the business a little bit more to understand what the business is about and understand some business considerations before advising the client on the right legal entity type. And as you mentioned, some of them are pretty common problems that everyone faces, right, when they start a new company, a new business. And this is the liability issues, how to protect your business assets, how to protect your personal assets, how to make sure there are some strong understandings among the co-founders, what's the management structure of the business, right? Taxation, as you said, is very important, attracting capital, attracting talent, how you're going to structure the relationships with your vendors, service providers. And of course, you also want to make sure you have a clear plan about the growth and the exit planning. And last but not least, we also have some regulatory compliance issues we have to keep in mind when we start a new business. And for startups specifically, I believe that Delaware C corporations address all these different factors we just mentioned. And Delaware C corporations are essentially the standard legal entity type for tech startups. And there are a number of reasons for that, right? Number one, it provides the limited liability and asset protection. And also, it's great for taxation purposes as well, because even though people may think of C corporations as entities that provide double taxation at the corporate level and the individual level, the reality is that for the first 5 years, maybe even more, you probably won't be seeing a lot of income to pay tax in the first place, because everything will be reinvested in the R&D and the growth of the company. So double taxation is not a big issue for early stage startups. But what C corporations provide is the qualified small business tax, qualified small business stock tax benefits, QSBS benefits. And these are huge benefits because essentially what they say is that if you open, you found a startup and it's a C corporation, and then you grow it and you sell it in 5-10 years, then you will get the first $10 million of the sale proceeds tax-free at the federal level. And if you think about this, this is a huge incentive, and this applies not only to the founders, but to anyone who gets shares from the company. That includes advisors, key employees, as well as the investors, right? So every stakeholder that becomes part of the company early on gets the QSBS benefit, which basically means you don't have to pay taxes on the first $10 million from the sale of from the proceeds of the sale of your stock. And of course, there are some limitations. Of course, there are some qualifications you have to meet in order to get this, these benefits. But also, there are a lot of ways how to maximize your QSBS benefits. So please make sure you think about taxation before setting up your entity. But it's not just about limited liabilities. It's not just about taxation. It's also about attracting capital and attracting talent. And C corporations are pretty great when it comes to equity incentives. There are very clear guidelines, tax guidelines when it comes to stock options, which is the main instrument that startups use to incentivize their employees and advisors, as well as the financing options, right? A lot of the instruments that we use to raise funding early on, such as SAFE agreements, right? And also preferred stock at seed stage or Series A stage. Those instruments are structured for C-Corp specifically. So if you change the entity type to an LLC or an S-Corp, then it will affect the actual agreements and you have to redraft them. And there are some tax implications as well. So the easiest, fastest, and the most streamlined way to raise funding would be to do it through a C-Corporation and using the standard SAFE or other investment documents. And why Delaware? It's pretty simple. It has been the most established jurisdiction for corporate entities, and they have really good courts. They have really good precedents, and attorneys and transactional people usually understand Delaware laws when it comes to corporations and some implications that they might have. So having a Delaware C corporation would definitely assist to close transactions faster.
I see. So legal documentation such as term sheets and investment agreements play a critical role in defining the rights and obligations of both the startup and the investor. What are the key terms and provisions a startup should include in a term sheet or investment agreement to protect their interests and ensure a fair deal for the investors?
Yeah, this is a great question. But before getting to that, I would want to talk a little more about the actual company, because I think the first thing that any founder needs to make sure they have in place before raising funding is the right corporate structure, right? You have the Delaware C Corp, which is great. But at the same time, Delaware C Corp in its own is just a shell entity, right? So you need to make sure that you file the certificate of incorporation, you authorize the right amount of shares, and the right amount would be 10 million or 100 million. You want to have a lot of shares to be able to issue to, you know, yourself, to your co-founders, and as well as the employees, advisors, consultants. And so it's super important to understand what you're doing in terms of authorizing the right number of shares. But also, you need to get the EIN, which is the federal tax ID number for any corporation. You need to get the foreign designation in other states that you operate in. For example, if you're a California business, but you have a Delaware entity, you still need to register your Delaware corporation in California. And those are all things that investors will look into, right? When they invest in your company, they want to make sure that you have all these different components in place, formalities in place, not to run into issues in the future. And those are very simple documents, right? So first off, you want to have the incorporator's consent, some board resolutions, issuing stock to the founders, and also appointing the officers of the corporation. So essentially, you do want to make sure for your own purposes that you issue shares to yourself, that you appoint the directors, you appoint the officers, to make sure that you understand who are the decision makers in the company when it comes to fundraising or other big decisions. And you also understand the cap table of your own company, understanding who owns how much, what are the vesting schedules, what they look like, and how the fundraising will affect the existing shareholders in terms of dilution of their existing stakes. So, you know, incorporator's consent, board resolutions, bylaws, of course, to set the main rules of how the corporation works. how the shareholders act, what the directors need to do, the duties and rights of the officers, and a lot of other things. And also, you want to make sure you sign simple stock purchase agreements with yourself as a founder and the company, and you have a vesting schedule in it to ensure that the investors can see that you are committed to the company in the long run, and you're incentivized to continue working hard to earn your stake in the company. And of course, you want to probably have an equity incentive plan that is a requirement to issue stock options to your employees and everyone else. And this is just one component, right? It's the cap table. It's the minimum formalities of any corporation. But before raising funding, you also want to make sure that you sign a few agreements with your staff and also maybe register your intellectual property. So number one, inventions assignment agreements. You want to ensure that all the IP developments that your employees or advisors come up with belongs to the company, right? Not to them, not to yourself individually, but to the company. Why? Because as an investor, when they make a decision to invest, they want to ensure that the company that they invest in is the legal owner of the intellectual property that the founders claim to have. So inventions, assignment agreements, and confidentiality agreements would be very important, essential at early stage, not just for the company and the founders, but also for the investors to have in place. And of course, you know, you want to make sure you, if you have a good trademark, you have a good brand, you want to protect that by registering it with the USPTO. So trademark registrations, any copyrights, patents that you may have. Of course, you want to talk to your patent and copyright advisors first before making a move, but those are good considerations to have in mind before raising funding, or even, you know, when you incorporate your entity. And as part of the due diligence, right? Because I'm looking at this as an investor, as an attorney. If I'm representing a startup, or I'm representing a venture capital fund making an investment, or I invest myself as an angel investor, in addition to these items I just mentioned, cap tables, formalities, intellectual property, I would also want to make sure that given the stage of the company, they have terms of use and privacy policy, right? They have all employment-related agreements, such as employment offers and letters, as well as arbitration agreements and some other employment-related agreements. I want to make sure they sign NDAs with people. They have some letters of intent, LOIs in place. They have really strong, good customer agreements in place with their customers. So those are all considerations, not just for the founders, but also for the investors. But of course, these different components really help the company. As it helps the company, it helps the founders, employees, as well as the investors, because everyone is aligned that they want to help the company, the founders bring the talent, their efforts, their services, and the investors bring the capital. So everyone's aligned that they want to have a strong, legally strong company in place before they make any investments.
So coming back to the key terms and provisions included in a term sheet or investment agreement, what would you mention? I would say valuation, governance, liquidation preferences, voting rights, anti-dilution protection. What else?
Yeah, those are good questions. And if you think about an early stage startup, right, most likely a pre-seed and seed stage, they will raise funding via SAFE instruments. SAFE, simple agreement for future equity. It's essentially a warrant that the startup issues to the investors, which essentially says that the investors will receive shares of preferred stock when the startup ends up raising an institutional round, a priced round later on. So SAFEs are not debt. It's just a convertible instrument, a warrant that converts into a stock later on. And as you already mentioned, the most important term in a SAFE agreement would be the valuation cap. And the valuation cap is interesting because The valuation cap essentially is the total value of the company at the transactional value of the company based on which the number of the shares that you receive as an investor will be calculated. So essentially, if the valuation cap is $10 million and you invest $1 million, then you can have a reasonable expectation of owning 10% of the company when the conversion takes place. And valuation cap essentially would be the most important term. Sometimes we see discounts added to the SAFE agreements, but also other important terms to focus on when you sign a SAFE, at least the first or the second time, is to understand the conversion events, the conversion mechanisms, right? How your SAFE is converted into shares of preferred stock or common stock. So there are a number of ways the conversion can be triggered. And the main way is equity financing, right? When the startup raises an equity round, a price round, and they receive funds from venture capital funds, and then the funds receive shares of preferred stock, that's exactly when your investment into a SAFE will convert into shares of preferred stock. And you don't have to pay extra money to do that. It's the same investment you made early on will turn into shares of preferred stock in the company. But this is just one conversion mechanism in a SAFE agreement. And this is probably the most important one. But then also the second one would be the liquidity event. And liquidity event essentially means the sale of the company, right? What if you invest $1 million now, a $10 million valuation, and then the company grows well, they use your money, and they grow the company, they accelerate the growth, they scale up their operations, and then they can sell before they even raise an institutional round, an equity round. So in that case, your SAFE would convert as well, either to common stock or just receive the proceeds from the sale. So for example, you invest in a company at $10 million valuation cap, $1 million. Then let's say the company is sold for $20 million, right? In that case, you would end up receiving close to $2 million because you invested at $10 million valuation and now the company is being sold for $20 million. So that's 2X and you receive $2 million. And if I'm not mistaken, there is an anti-dilution protection in the SAFE, essentially saying that if the company is being sold for $5 million, let's say, you might have a right to receive your $1 million first before anyone else gets paid. And the same applies to dissolution events. When the company is being dissolved, you get your money first before anyone else gets paid. But of course, right? If it's not a sale, instead it's a dissolution of the company, which basically means you close down the company. It's hard to imagine that there is anything left in the company, or even if there's something left, there's going to be very, very small amount of money and some maybe IP assets. So it's not likely that the investors will receive anything close to what they invested, especially if they invested a larger amount. So again, three main conversion events: equity financing, in which case your SAFE investment converts into shares of preferred stock at the $10 million valuation in our example. Liquidity event, which is the sale of the company. Again, you get a portion of the proceeds back based on the $10 million valuation. And the last one is dissolution, which essentially means the company probably failed and there is nothing left in the company. But legally speaking, you still do have some protection because you need to get paid first before anyone else gets paid. But this is interesting because SAFE would be the standard document, right? And I'm sure you've seen a lot of SAFE investments, and you guys as Triple S Ventures, I'm sure are making a lot of SAFE investments. Mm-hmm. But the one situation where I would probably advise investing via a convertible note versus a SAFE is a situation where the company already has existing convertible notes, right? And the reason for this is that, legally speaking, convertible notes have a priority, liquidation priority over safe instruments because it's debt versus a warrant or equity or a hybrid instrument. So if the company already has convertible notes, then most likely would make sense either to invest via a convertible note to have the same liquidity preference as the previous investors, or at least to have some sort of a document drafted saying that you either subordinate convertible notes to the safe, or most likely you treat them pari passu, which basically means you treat them equally in a liquidation event. So this is a very minor but important detail that you need to keep in mind when you think about safes and convertible notes.
One more point that I would like to add is entrepreneurs also have to pay attention whether they're using post or pre-money valuation, which will eventually affect the ownership they end up with when their notes or safes convert.
Precisely. Yeah, that's a really good point. And pre-money safes used to be the standard 5 years ago, but then post-money safe was released. And the post-money safe essentially says that if the valuation is $10 million from the investor's point of view, right? If the value is $10 million post-money valuation, that's the cap, then if you invest $1 million, then you get 10% essentially. You don't get diluted if more investors join the financing round. So essentially, if I invest $1 million and then you invest $1 million, we each get 10%. We don't dilute each other. So the founders need to pay attention to that. And also post-money safe just makes it easier in terms of understanding the clear ownership structure for both the investors and the founders to know that if I have a $10 million post-money valuation cap and my round is for up to $20 million, then you realize that you're going to get diluted for 20%. If you end up raising 2.5, then you get only 25%. If you end up raising less than $2 million, then again, you know how much exactly you get diluted. So post-money safe definitely helps with these calculations. But those are important, but there are some other terms I would definitely want founders and investors to pay attention to. And again, as you mentioned, liquidation priority, right? So convertible notes first or debt first, then safes and preferred stock, and then common. So if you sell the company for $10 million and you have convertible notes for $10 million, then they will receive all of that. Safe holders won't receive anything because, again, a debt has priority over safe or preferred or common stock. So again, things to pay attention to. No prepayment in safe. So the founder cannot just wake up one morning and decide that he wants to pay my $1 million back and terminate my safe agreement. So no prepayments. There could be some amendments in safes. And this is very interesting as well, because you don't have to, as an investor, you don't necessarily need to approve every single amendment to the safes. So imagine a $3 million round and I invest only $1 million. And if there is a change in the safe that the $2 million, the investors who hold $2 million approve, my approval may not even be necessary because I'm not a majority in this round. So essentially, some changes, amendments to the safe can be made via a majority of investors versus individual consent. But that being said, you need to be asked, right? You need to be notified about the amendment. They need to ask you the question before they make the change. You may say yes, you may say no, but asking the question, asking if you approve the amendment is super important. But also, if there is any change that will affect your individual stake in the company, such as, let's say, reducing the or changing the valuation cap, increasing the valuation cap, right? In that case, your individual, as an investor, your individual approval would be necessary. So founders should know that they cannot just change the amendments without first reaching out to the investors. A few other things, representations. Investors say that they're accredited investors, that they're not breaking any laws by signing this agreement. So very basic representations from investors to the company, then from the company to the investors as well about certain things. and then taxation. It's interesting because even though SAFE is a warrant, right, it's not equity, the drafters of a SAFE, of the SAFE agreement, Y Combinator folks, they included in the SAFE agreement that for tax purposes, SAFE should be treated as equity, right? And the intention there is to make sure that you get some benefits as an equity holder, even though you're holding SAFE instrument versus an actual shares of the company. And this is great, but at the same time, just because it says in the agreement that the SAFE will be treated as an equity does not mean that the IRS will necessarily honor that. So you will still need to have a conversation with the IRS and try to convince them that SAFEs are equity, not warrant, which is going to be probably hard to do. And another thing is that you can assign or transfer your SAFE to someone else. So founders need to make sure that they know what their investors are doing with their SAFEs in terms of assigning them to other people. I think I addressed most of the, you know, areas I wanted to address with respect to the SAFE. So if we can move on to the next question, that would be great.
Sure. Let's talk about intellectual property protection. Startups often rely on intellectual property assets such as patents, trademarks, or copyrights to create value and gain a competitive advantage. Protecting and managing IP can be complex, involving filing applications, maintaining confidentiality, enforcing rights, and avoiding infringement. Failure to adequately protect your IP can lead to costly disputes or loss of valuable assets. So what are the different options for startups to protect their IP and what should be paid attention to when choosing one?
Yeah. And look, these are great points. Intellectual property is super important. That's the crown jewel of any startup. And investors like to see some new IP developed in a startup that increases the value of the startup and increases the chances of the startup to succeed. Just to be fair, I'm not an intellectual property attorney, so anyone who's thinking about IP protections needs to consult an intellectual property attorney. And at Ramon, we have really good intellectual property attorneys that you can always talk to. And you're right, in terms of issues down the road, I have clients who have not registered their trademarks or other critical intellectual property rights with the USPTO or other authorities. And because of that, they ended up in big troubles because it turned out that either someone else has been using their name or they have been using someone else's name, which is probably even worse. So it's critical to do some diligence to investigate the intellectual property, the names, the trademarks, logos that you're using early on to ensure there are no conflicts, and also maybe registering them potentially to ensure full protection for yourself and investors. And there are a few types of intellectual property rights, trademarks, copyrights, patents, as well as trade secrets. So if you suspect that your startup might have any of these IP items, most certainly reach out to an IP attorney and talk to them about the potential possible ways to protect your IP to ensure, to minimize the risk of getting into trouble in the future.
So what are the potential legal consequences or liabilities if a startup fails to deliver on the promises made to investors? And what steps can be taken to mitigate these risks?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And this has a lot to do with securities regulations, right? And also due diligence, I would say. And this is something that both the startup founders and the investors must be responsible for, because it's hard to expect the startup founder who just started, maybe it's their first startup, who has a lot on his or her plate, to understand the regulations and to understand the processes very well. So essentially, at least you want to make sure that the startup has an attorney, or if they don't have an attorney, at least your attorney as an investor looks into the startup to understand where they are in terms of their legal compliance. And number one, of course, is the simple due diligence. You want to make sure they have the C-Corp, they have the IP protections, right? The IP assignment agreements in place. They have the cap table, clean cap table. You know exactly how much different people own, how much ownership they have in the company. You want to have a smaller data room, right? And data rooms are great because you can go there and see exactly the documents you want to review. And there are some great tools for that, Corpora being one of them. They do provide that service of providing digital data rooms for investors and the companies and their attorneys to work well together. So make sure there's a data room. Make sure you review the cap table, the IP assignments, maybe some IP registrations. Hopefully there are no liabilities and everyone has a stock purchase agreement signed with a vesting schedule. But also you want to go through the process. The right process for any investment would be first, you know, understanding the business issues. Once you feel comfortable about the business itself, then you turn into the financial and legal issues. You want to have a term sheet, even for a safe, right? You want to have at least an understanding in terms of the actual amount that you're investing and also the actual evaluation cap that you're investing under. So those would be the main items in the term sheet. And then you get into drafting the actual investment documents. If it's a safe, then you'll just probably end up using the Y Combinator's template. Then you will end up signing, wiring the funds and getting the confirmation. So again, very important to ensure that you go through the right process of investing. And in terms of drafting, and we'll talk about this later too, in the past, safes were essentially the only document you sign in terms of the actual investment document. But nowadays, because of the slowdown and the funding activity at different stages, including pre-seed and seed, as well as the short supply of cash, of money, and the venture capital industry, you also see a lot of side letters being drafted and signed in addition to the actual safe template, which provides additional protections to the investors. And after you're done with this, you did your diligence, you went through the process of term sheet drafting, signing, and wiring, and getting the confirmation of the wire. You also want to ensure that some simple securities regulations are addressed, and those are investment regulations that the government in the US imposes on any company or any founder who seeks to raise funding, right? And you would think, oh, maybe this is a friends and family round, so it's a small round. Those are my friends and my family members. I know everyone. So these regulations probably do not apply to private transaction. If you're thinking that, then you're wrong in your assumption, because every single fundraising in the U.S. needs to be either a registered round, which is the IPOs, which is not going to happen at the early stages, or it has to be exempt from registration. And exemption does not mean you just walk away from any regulations. It instead means that you have to comply with reduced number of regulations in order to raise funding legally. And those are simpler, you know, processes and simpler steps you need to take. First, you have to disclose some information about the company, right? You have to answer the questions that the investors send. And in terms of disclosures, I always go with a list of risk factors about the company, about the stage of the company, about the industry, about the actual investment documents. And those risk factors can vary based on the industry, stage of the company, but it's always a good idea to disclose some risks to the investors. And sometimes we draft investment questionnaires to make sure that we know for a fact that the investors are accredited investors, which means they make over $200,000 a year, or they have at least a net worth of $1 million, excluding their primary residence. So the purpose here is to ensure that the investors have enough money to protect themselves, have enough money to hire attorneys and financial experts to help them with the decision. And sometimes you also want to make sure that they're sophisticated enough, they understand the risks of a safe or C-note or even a priced investments in your startup. So questionnaires could be important as well to ensure that you work with accredited investors only. And in addition to that, you should also file a Form D, right? A Form D is a very simple notice that you file with the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. That's the federal body that oversees investments in the United States. So you need to also file the Form D with the government. And also you have to file similar notifications, notices at the state level, right? In California, New York, other states, those are called blue sky laws. And you want to make sure that you also notify the local governments about the funding round. And those are important steps to, and it's crucial to follow these formalities, because if something goes wrong and there is an issue between the founders and the investors, if you follow these steps, right, you go through a due diligence process, then you have legit negotiations that are documented in a term sheet and then drafting the actual documents. And then you, in fact, disclose the risk factors and you have questionnaires in place and you also file the Form D. As long as you comply as a founder with the minimum requirements and you don't lie, you don't misrepresent anything to your investors, then if something goes wrong down the road, things go south and there is a negative relationship developing between the parties, you can always point out to the fact that, you know, we honored all the laws, regulations, we made disclosures, we filed notifications with the government, we answered all your questions. As long as you can prove to show that you went through the right process, then you should be in a good spot in that dispute. But of course, more importantly than legal, it would be very helpful to communicate with the investors, not just before they make an investment, but also continue communicating with them and trying to maintain a good, healthy working relationship with your investors, because it's not just the capital that they invest. They can also help with introductions and strategic advice. And also, of course, they can invest in your future rounds if you maintain a good, strong relationships with them.
Could you please provide guidance on any other legal matters or considerations that startups commonly overlook but should be aware of to ensure long-term success and compliance? Something that we didn't get the chance to discuss yet.
Yeah, I think we discussed pretty much everything, and you would be surprised, right? When you work with startups, you look at their documents. Sometimes the mistakes are so simple, they could have been avoided if they just reached out to an attorney early on. And by the way, when I say this, I do understand that attorney's fees are expensive, that a lot of startups can't afford them. But it's always a good idea to reach out to someone to talk to them for 30 minutes. I'm sure they will do it for free as a consultation, just to understand the main legal issues. And this is, of course, in addition to doing some research on your own. So always reach out to a startup attorney or a corporate attorney to discuss these matters. And the simplest things, right? The cap tables need to be in place, IP protections, and you'd be surprised how many startups don't have IP assignment agreements in place. They don't have the right documents for the founders to receive stock, some cap table issues, disputes among the founders. So as long as you start early on, you document everything in a proper manner, then you should be in a good position. But to talk a little more about the investment side and what's happening in the market currently and what startups need to be aware of, there are a number of things that are happening. Some are economic that drive these changes, but also legal changes are driven by these economic changes in the market. As you know, and I'm sure a lot of the startup founders know, the valuations are going down, the investment activities are down as well. So as investors are investing less money, less cash in startups, the valuations are dropping as well. And we'll see what's going to happen in the next few quarters. It can either go up, it can stay the same, or it can, you know, continue going down in terms of both the transaction sizes, transaction volume, and the actual valuations. And because of that, we see a lot of flag rounds or down rounds. So it's not just lower valuations, right? It's not just you could raise money at 10 million, now you have to go down to 7. It's also that the people that raised funding at $10 million in 2022 or 2021. Now they either need to continue raising 2 years from then at the same valuation, which is the flat round, or they have to actually decrease their valuation to be able to raise extra funding. And this is not good from an economic point of view, because that means that when the investment was made a year or 2 years ago, the assumptions were wrong. We're assuming that the company will be able to raise funding at $10 or $15 million in 2 or 1 year from then. But in fact, it either stayed flat or the valuation even went down, which means either something went wrong or our assumptions were inaccurate to begin with, which could be, you know, not just a mistake or an omission on the investor's part in terms of not doing due diligence, not understanding the company, its potential, but also the larger economic factors that drive a lot of these valuation issues. And these economic changes definitely affect some of the legal documents that we as attorneys draft for our clients and the deals we structure for our clients. And I have been seeing a lot more side letters being signed with, in addition to just a simple safe agreement. You know, you just get pro rata rights, you get governance rights, information rights, you have to give extra rights to the investors sometimes in the side letter to be able to close the deal.
Hike, thank you so much. This has been very informative and it was a pleasure to talk to you today. I'm sure our conversation will guide startups in the right direction to target their legal questions and considerations. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.